Swan's Way. Remembrance of Things Past, Volume 1. By Marcel Proust. Overture. For a long time I used to go to bed early. Sometimes when I'd put out my candle, my eyes would close so quickly that I had not even time to say, "I'm going to sleep." And half an hour later, the thought that it was time to go to sleep would awaken me. I would try to put away the book, which I imagined was still in my hands, and to blow out the light. I had been thinking all the time while I was asleep of what I had just been reading, but my thoughts had run into a channel of their own, until I myself seemed actually to have become the subject of my book, a church, a quartet, the rivalry between François I and Charles V. This impression would persist for some moments after I was awake. It did not disturb my mind, but it lay like scales upon my eyes and prevented them from registering the fact that the candle was no longer burning. Then it would begin to seem unintelligible, as the thoughts of a former existence must be to a reincarnate spirit. The subject of my book would separate itself from me, leaving me free to choose whether I would form part of it or no, and at the same time my sight would return, and I would be astonished to find myself in a state of darkness, pleasant and restful enough for the eyes, and even more perhaps for my mind, to which it appeared incomprehensible, without a cause, a matter dark indeed. I would ask myself what o'clock it could be. I could hear the whistling of trains, which now nearer and now farther off, punctuating the distance like the note of a bird in a forest, showed me in perspective the deserted countryside through which a traveller would be hurrying towards the nearest station, the path that he followed being fixed for ever in his memory by the general excitement due to being in a strange place, to doing unusual things, to the last words of conversation, to farewells exchanged beneath an unfamiliar lamp which echoed still in his ears amid the silence of the night, and to the delightful prospect of being once again at home. I would lay my cheeks gently against the comfortable cheeks of my pillow, as plump and blooming as the cheeks of babyhood. Or I would strike a match to look at my watch. Nearly midnight. The hour when an invalid, who has been obliged to start on a journey and to sleep in a strange hotel, awakens in a moment of illness and sees with glad relief a streak of daylight showing under his bedroom door. Oh, joy of joys, it is morning. The servants will be about in a minute. He can ring and someone will come to look after him. The thought of being made comfortable gives him strength to endure his pain. He is certain he heard footsteps. They come nearer and then die away. The ray of light beneath his door is extinguished. It is midnight. Someone has turned out the gas. The last servant has gone to bed, and he must lie all night in agony with no one to bring him any help. I would fall asleep, and often I would be awake again for short snatches only, just long enough to hear the regular creaking of the wainscot, or to open my eyes to settle the shifting kaleidoscope of the darkness, to savour, in an instantaneous flash of perception, the sleep which lay heavy upon the furniture, the room, the whole surroundings of which I formed but an insignificant part, and whose unconsciousness I should very soon return to share. Or perhaps, while I was asleep, I had returned without the least effort to an earlier stage in my life, now forever outgrown, and had come under the thrall of one of my childish terrors, such as that old terror of my great-uncle's pulling my curls, which was effectually dispelled on the day, the dawn of a new era to me, on which they were finally cropped from my head. I had forgotten that event during my sleep. I remembered it again immediately I had succeeded in making myself wake up to escape my great-uncle's fingers. Still, as a measure of precaution, I would bury the whole of my head in the pillow before returning to the world of dreams. Sometimes, too, Just as Eve was created from a rib of Adam, so a woman would come into existence while I was sleeping, conceived from some strain in the position of my limbs. Formed by the appetite that I was on the point of gratifying, she it was, I imagined, who offered me that gratification. My body, conscious that its own warmth was permeating hers, would strive to become one with her, and I would awake. The rest of humanity seemed very remote in comparison with this woman whose company I had left but a moment ago. My cheek was still warm with her kiss, my body bent beneath the weight of hers. If, as would sometimes happen, she had the appearance of some woman whom I had known in waking hours, I would abandon myself altogether to the sole quest of her, like people who set out on a journey to see with their own eyes some city that they have always longed to visit, and imagine that they can taste in reality what has charmed their fancy. And then, gradually, the memory of her would dissolve and vanish, until I had forgotten the maiden of my dream. When a man is asleep, he has in a circle round him the chain of the hours, the sequence of the years, the order of the heavenly host. Instinctively, when he awakes, he looks to these, and in an instant reads off his own position on the earth's surface and the amount of time that has elapsed during his slumbers. But this ordered procession is apt to grow confused and to break its ranks. Suppose that, towards morning after a night of insomnia, sleep descends upon him while he is reading. In quite a different position from that in which he normally goes to sleep, he has only to lift his arm to arrest the sun and turn it back in its course, and at the moment of waking he will have no idea of the time, but will conclude that he has just gone to bed. Or suppose that he gets drowsy in some even more abnormal position, sitting in an armchair, say, after dinner. Then the world will fall topsy-turvy from its orbit, the magic chair will carry him at full speed through time and space, and when he opens his eyes again, he will imagine that he went to sleep months earlier, and in some far distant country. But for me, it was enough if, in my own bed, my sleep was so heavy as completely to relax my consciousness. For then I lost all sense of the place in which I had gone to sleep, and when I awoke at midnight, not knowing where I was, I could not be sure at first who I was. I had only the most rudimentary sense of existence, such as may lurk and flicker in the depths of an animal's consciousness. I was more destitute of human qualities than the cave dweller. But then the memory, not yet of the place in which I was, but of various other places where I had lived, and might now very possibly be, would come like a rope let down from heaven to draw me up out of the abyss of not-being, from which I could never have escaped by myself. In a flash I would traverse and surmount centuries of civilization, and out of a half-visualized succession of oil lamps followed by shirts with turned-down collars, would put together by degrees the component parts of my ego. Perhaps the immobility of the things that surround us is forced upon them by our conviction that they are themselves and not anything else, and by the immobility of our conceptions of them. For it always happened that when I awoke like this, and my mind struggled in an unsuccessful attempt to discover where I was, everything would be moving round me through the darkness, things, places, years. My body, still too heavy with sleep to move, would make an effort to construe the form which its tiredness took as an orientation of its various members, so as to induce from that where the wall lay and the furniture stood, to piece together and to give a name to the house in which it must be living. Its memory, the composite memory of its ribs, knees, and shoulder blades, offered it a whole series of rooms in which it had at one time or another slept, while the unseen walls kept changing, adapting themselves to the shape of each successive room that it remembered, whirling madly through the darkness, and even before my brain, lingering in consideration of when things had happened and of what they had looked like, had collected sufficient impressions to enable it to identify the room, it, my body, would recall from each room in succession what the bed was like, where the doors were, how daylight came in at the windows, whether there was a passage outside, what I had had in my mind when I went to sleep, and had found there when I awoke. The stiffened side underneath my body would, for instance, in trying to fix its position, imagine itself to be lying face to the wall in a big bed with a canopy. And at once I would say to myself, "Why, I must have gone to sleep after all. And Mama never came to say good night." For I was in the country with my grandfather, who died years ago, and my body, the side upon which I was lying, loyally preserving from the past an impression which my mind should never have forgotten, brought back before my eyes the glimmering flame of the nightlight in its bowl of Bohemian glass, shaped like an urn and hung by chains from the ceiling, and the chimney-piece of Siena marble in my bedroom at Cambrai, in my great-aunt's house. In those far distant days, which at the moment of waking seemed present without being clearly defined, but would become plainer in a little while when I was properly awake. Then would come up the memory of a fresh position. The wall slid away in another direction. I was in my room in Madame de Saint-Loup's house, in the country. Good heavens, it must be 10 o'clock. They will have finished dinner. I must have overslept myself in the little nap which I always take when I come in from my walk with Madame de Saint-Loup before dressing for the evening. For many years have now elapsed since the Cambrai days, when coming in from the longest and latest walks, I would still be in time to see the reflection of the sunset glowing in the panes of my bedroom window. It is a very different kind of existence at Tonsonville, now with Madame de Saint-Loup, and a different kind of pleasure that I now derive from taking walks only in the evenings, from visiting by moonlight the roads on which I used to play as a child in the sunshine. While the bedroom in which I shall presently fall asleep instead of dressing for dinner, from afar off I can see it as we return from our walk, with its lamp shining through the window, a solitary beacon in the night. These shifting and confused gusts of memory never lasted for more than a few seconds. It often happened that in my spell of uncertainty as to where I was, I did not distinguish the successive theories of which that uncertainty was composed any more than when we watch a horse running, we isolate the successive positions of its body as they appear upon a bioscope. But I had seen first one and then another of the rooms in which I had slept during my life, and in the end I would revisit them all in the long course of my waking dream. Rooms in winter where, on going to bed, I would at once bury my head in a nest built up out of the most diverse materials, the corner of my pillow, the top of my blankets, a piece of a shawl, the edge of my bed, and a copy of an evening paper, all of which things I would contrive with the infinite patience of birds building their nests to cement into one whole. Rooms where, in a keen frost, I would feel the satisfaction of being shut in from the outer world, like the sea swallow which builds at the end of a dark tunnel and is kept warm by the surrounding earth, and where, the fire keeping in all night, I would sleep wrapped up, as it were, in a great cloak of snug and savoury air, shot with the glow of the logs which would break out again in flame, in a sort of alcove without walls, a cave of warmth dug out of the heart of the room itself, a zone of heat whose boundaries were constantly shifting and altering in temperature as gusts of air ran across them to strike freshly upon my face from the corners of the room or from parts near the window or far from the fireplace, which had therefore remained cold, or rooms in summer, where I would delight to feel myself a part of the warm evening, where the moonlight striking upon the half-open shutters would throw down to the foot of my bed its enchanted ladder, where I would fall asleep, as it might be in the open air, like a titmouse which the breeze keeps poised in the focus of a sunbeam, or sometimes the Louis XVI room, so cheerful that I could never feel really unhappy, even on my first night in it, that room where the slender columns which lightly supported its ceiling would part, ever so gracefully, to indicate where the bed was and to keep it separate. Sometimes, again, that little room with the high ceiling, hollowed in the form of a pyramid, out of two separate stories, and partly walled with mahogany, in which from the first moment my mind was drugged by the unfamiliar scent of flowering grasses, convinced of the hostility of the violet curtains and of the insolent indifference of a clock that chattered on at the top of its voice as though I were not there, while a strange and pitiless mirror with square feet which stood across one corner of the room cleared for itself a sight I had not looked to find tenanted in the quiet surroundings of my normal field of vision. That room in which my mind, forcing itself for hours on end to leave its moorings, to elongate itself upwards so as to take on the exact shape of the room and to reach to the summit of that monstrous funnel, had passed so many anxious nights while my body lay stretched out in bed, my eyes staring upwards, my ears straining, my nostrils sniffing uneasily, and my heart beating. Until custom had changed the colour of the curtains, made the clock keep quiet, brought an expression of pity to the cruel slanting face of the glass, disguised or even completely dispelled the scent of flowering grasses, and distinctly reduced the apparent loftiness of the ceiling. Custom, that skilful but unhurrying manager who begins by torturing the mind for weeks on end with her provisional arrangements, whom the mind, for all that, is fortunate in discovering, for without the help of custom, it would never contrive by its own efforts to make any room seem habitable. Certainly, I was now well awake. My body had turned about for the last time, and the good angel of certainty had made all the surrounding objects stand still, had set me down under my bedclothes, in my bedroom, and had fixed, approximately in their right places in the uncertain light, my chest of drawers, my writing table, my fireplace, the window overlooking the street, and both the doors. But it was no good my knowing that I was not in any of those houses of which, in the stupid moment of waking, if I had not caught sight exactly, I could still believe in their possible presence, for memory was now set in motion. As a rule, I did not attempt to go to sleep again at once, but used to spend the greater part of the night recalling our life in the old days at Cambrai with my great-aunt, at Balbec, Paris, Doncières, Venice, and the rest, remembering again all the places and people that I had known, what I had actually seen of them, and what others had told me. At Cambrai, as every afternoon ended, long before the time when I should have to go up to bed and to lie there unsleeping, far from my mother and grandmother, my bedroom became the fixed point on which my melancholy and anxious thoughts were centred. Someone had had the happy idea of giving me, to distract me on evenings when I seemed abnormally wretched, a magic lantern, which used to be set on top of my lamp while we waited for dinner time to come. In the manner of the master builders and glass painters of Gothic days, it substituted for the opaqueness of my walls an impalpable iridescence, supernatural phenomena of many colours, in which legends were depicted as on a shifting and transitory window. But my sorrows were only increased, because this change of lighting destroyed, as nothing else could have done, the customary impression I had formed of my room, thanks to which the room itself, but for the torture of having to go to bed in it, had become quite endurable. For now, I no longer recognized it, and I became uneasy, as though I were in a room in some hotel or furnished lodging, in a place where I had just arrived by train for the first time. Riding at a jerky trot, Golo, his mind filled with an infamous design, issued from the little three-cornered forest which dyed dark green the slope of a convenient hill, and advanced by leaps and bounds towards the castle of poor Genevieve de Brabant. This castle was cut off short by a curved line, which was in fact the circumference of one of the transparent ovals in the slides, which were pushed into position through a slot in the lantern. It was only the wing of a castle, and in front of it stretched a moor on which Genevieve stood, lost in contemplation, wearing a blue girdle. The castle and the moor were yellow, but I could tell their colour without waiting to see them, for before the slides made their appearance, the old gold sonorous name of Brabant had given me an unmistakable clue. Golo stopped for a moment and listened sadly to the little speech read aloud by my great-aunt, which he seemed perfectly to understand, for he modified his attitude with a docility not devoid of a degree of majesty so as to conform to the indications given in the text. Then he rode away at the same jerky trot. And nothing could arrest his slow progress. If the lantern were moved, I could still distinguish Golo's horse advancing across the window curtains, swelling out with their curves and diving into their folds. The body of Golo himself, being of the same supernatural substance as his steeds, overcame all material obstacles, everything that seemed to bar his way, by taking each as it might be a skeleton and embodying it in himself. The door handle, for instance, over which, adapting itself at once, would float invincibly his red cloak or his pale face, never losing its nobility or its melancholy, never showing any sign of trouble at such a transubstantiation. And indeed, I found plenty of charm in these bright projections, which seemed to have come straight out of a Merovingian past, and to shed around me the reflections of such ancient history. But I cannot express the discomfort I felt at such an intrusion of mystery and beauty into a room which I had succeeded in filling with my own personality until I thought no more of the room than of myself. The anesthetic effect of custom being destroyed, I would begin to think and to feel very melancholy things. The door handle of my room, which was different to me from all the other door handles in the world, inasmuch as it seemed to open of its own accord and without my having to turn it, so unconscious had its manipulation become, lo and behold, it was now an astral body for Golo. And as soon as the dinner bell rang, I would run down to the dining-room where the big hanging lamp, ignorant of Golo and Bluebeard, but well acquainted with my family and the dish of stewed beef, shed the same light as on every other evening, and I would fall into the arms of my mother, whom the misfortunes of Genevieve de Brabant had made all the dearer to me, just as the crimes of Golo had driven me to a more than ordinarily scrupulous examination of my own conscience. But after dinner, alas, I was soon obliged to leave Mama, who stayed talking with the others, in the garden if it was fine, or in the little parlour where everyone took shelter when it was wet. Everyone except my grandmother, who held that it is a pity to shut oneself indoors in the country, and used to carry on endless discussions with my father on the very wettest days, because he would send me up to my room with a book instead of letting me stay out of doors. That is not the way to make him strong and active, she would say sadly, especially this little man, who needs all the strength and character that he can get. My father would shrug his shoulders and study the barometer, for he took an interest in meteorology, while my mother, keeping very quiet so as not to disturb him, looked at him with tender respect but not too hard, not wishing to penetrate the mysteries of his superior mind. But my grandmother, in all weathers, even when the rain was coming down in torrents, and Françoise had rushed indoors with the precious wicker armchairs so that they should not get soaked, you would see my grandmother pacing the deserted garden, lashed by the storm, pushing back her grey hair in disorder, so that her brows might be more free to imbibe the life-giving draughts of wind and rain. She would say, "At last, one can breathe," and would run up and down the soaking paths, too straight and symmetrical for her liking, owing to the want of any feeling for nature in the new gardener, whom my father had been asking all morning if the weather were going to improve, with her keen, jerky little step, regulated by the various effects wrought upon her soul by the intoxication of the storm, the force of hygiene, the stupidity of my education, and of symmetry in gardens, rather than by any anxiety, for that was quite unknown to her, to save her plum-coloured skirt from the spots of mud under which it would gradually disappear to a depth which always provided her maid with a fresh problem and filled her with fresh despair. When these walks of my grandmother's took place after dinner, there was one thing which never failed to bring her back to the house. That was if, at one of those points when the revolutions of her course brought her, moth-like, in sight of the lamp in the little parlour, where the liqueurs were set out on the card-table, my great-aunt called out to her, "Bathilde, come in and stop your husband from drinking brandy." For simply to tease her, she had brought so foreign a type of mind into my father's family that everyone made a joke of it. My great-aunt used to make my grandfather, who was forbidden liqueurs, take just a few drops. My poor grandmother would come in and beg and implore her husband not to taste the brandy, and he would become annoyed and swallow his few drops all the same, and she would go out again, sad and discouraged, but still smiling, for she was so humble and so sweet that her gentleness towards others and her continual subordination of herself and of her own troubles appeared on her face, blended in a smile which, unlike those seen on the majority of human faces, had no trace in it of irony, save for herself, while for all of us kisses seemed to spring from her eyes, which could not look upon those she loved without yearning to bestow upon them passionate caresses. The torments inflicted on her by my great-aunt, the sight of my grandmother's vain entreaties, of her in her weakness conquered before she began, but still making the futile endeavour to wean my grandfather from his liqueur glass, all these were things of the sort to which in later years one can grow so well accustomed as to smile at them, to take the tormentor's side with a happy determination which deludes one into the belief that it is not really tormenting. But in those days they filled me with such horror that I longed to strike my great-aunt. And yet, as soon as I heard her, "Bathilde, come in and stop your husband from drinking brandy," in my cowardice I became at once a man, and did what all we grown men do when face to face with suffering and injustice. I preferred not to see them. I ran up to the top of the house to cry by myself, in a little room beside the schoolroom and beneath the roof, which smelt of orris root, and was scented also by a wild currant bush which had climbed up between the stones of the outer wall, and thrust a flowering branch in through the half-opened window. Intended for a more special and baser use, this room, from which in the daytime I could see as far as the keep of Roussainville-le-Pin, was for a long time my place of refuge, doubtless because it was the only room whose door I was allowed to lock, whenever my occupation was such as required an inviolable solitude, reading or dreaming, secret tears or paroxysms of desire. Alas, I little knew that my own lack of willpower, my delicate health, and the consequent uncertainty as to my future weighed far more heavily on my grandmother's mind than any little breach of the rules by her husband during those endless perambulations, afternoon and evening, in which we used to see passing up and down, obliquely raised towards the heavens, her handsome face with its brown and wrinkled cheeks, which with age had acquired almost the purple hue of tilled fields in autumn, covered, if she were walking abroad, by a half-lifted veil, while upon them either the cold or some sad reflection invariably left the drying traces of an involuntary tear. My sole consolation when I went upstairs for the night was that Mamma would come in and kiss me after I was in bed. But this good night lasted for so short a time. She went down again so soon that the moment in which I heard her climb the stairs and then caught the sound of her garden dress of blue muslin, from which hung little tassels of plaited straw, rustling along the double-doored corridor, was for me a moment of the keenest sorrow. So much did I love that good night that I reached the stage of hoping that it would come as late as possible, so as to prolong the time of respite during which Mamma would not yet have appeared. Sometimes when, after kissing me, she opened the door to go, I longed to call her back and say to her, "Kiss me just once again." But I knew then she would at once look displeased, for the concession which she made to my wretchedness and agitation in coming up to me with this kiss of peace always annoyed my father, who thought such ceremonies absurd, and she would have liked to try to induce me to outgrow the need, the custom of having her there at all, which was a very different thing from letting the custom grow up of my asking her for an additional kiss when she was already crossing the threshold. And to see her look displeased destroyed all the sense of tranquillity she had brought me a moment before, when she bent her loving face down over my bed and held it out to me like a host for an act of communion in which my lips might drink deeply the sense of her real presence, and with it the power to sleep. But those evenings on which Mamma stayed so short a time in my room were sweet indeed, compared to those on which we had guests to dinner, and therefore she did not come at all. Our guests were practically limited to Monsieur Swann, who, apart from a few passing strangers, was almost the only person who ever came to the house at Cambrai, sometimes to a neighbourly dinner, but less frequently since his unfortunate marriage, as my family did not care to receive his wife, and sometimes after dinner, uninvited. On those evenings when, as we sat in front of the house beneath the big chestnut tree and round the iron table, we heard from the far end of the garden not the large and noisy rattle, which heralded and deafened as he approached with its ferruginous, interminable, frozen sound any member of the household who had put it out of action by coming in without ringing, but the double peal, timid, oval, gilded, of the visitor's bell. Everyone would at once exclaim, "A visitor! Who in the world can it be?" But they knew quite well that it could only be Monsieur Swann. My great aunt, speaking in a loud voice to set an example, in a tone which she endeavoured to make sound natural, would tell the others not to whisper so, that nothing could be more unpleasant for a stranger coming in, who would be led to think that people were saying things about him which he was not meant to hear. And then my grandmother would be sent out as a scout, always happy to find an excuse for an additional turn in the garden, which she would utilize to remove surreptitiously as she passed the stakes of a rose tree or two, so as to make the roses look a little more natural, as a mother might run her hand through her boy's hair after the barber had smoothed it down, to make it stick out properly round his head. And there we would all stay, hanging on the words which would fall from my grandmother's lips when she brought us back her report of the enemy, as though there had been some uncertainty among a vast number of possible invaders. And then, soon after, my grandfather would say, "I can hear Swann's voice." And indeed, One could tell him only by his voice, for it was difficult to make out his face with its arched nose and green eyes under a high forehead fringed with fair, almost red hair, dressed in the Bresson style, because in the garden we used as little light as possible so as not to attract mosquitoes. And I would slip away, as though not going for anything in particular, to tell them to bring out the syrups, for my grandmother made a great point, thinking it nicer of their not being allowed to seem anything out of the ordinary, which we kept for visitors only. Although a far younger man, Monsieur Swann was very much attached to my grandfather, who had been an intimate friend in his time of Swann's father, an excellent but eccentric man, in whom the least little thing would, it seemed, often check the flow of his spirits and divert the current of his thoughts. Several times in the course of a year I would hear my grandfather tell at table the story, which never varied, of the behaviour of Monsieur Swann the elder upon the death of his wife, by whose bedside he had watched day and night. My grandfather, who had not seen him for a long time, hastened to join him at the Swann's family property on the outskirts of Combray, and managed to entice him for a moment, weeping profusely, out of the death chamber, so that he should not be present when the body was laid in its coffin. They took a turn or two in the park, where there was a little sunshine. Suddenly, Monsieur Swann seized my grandfather by the arm and cried, "Oh, my dear old friend, how fortunate we are to be walking here together on such a charming day! Don't you see how pretty they are, all these trees, my hawthorns and my new pond, on which you have never congratulated me? You look as glum as a nightcap. Don't you feel this little breeze? Ah, whatever you may say, it's good to be alive all the same, my dear Amédée." And then, abruptly, the memory of his dead wife returned to him, and probably thinking it too complicated to inquire into how, at such a time, he could have allowed himself to be carried away by an impulse of happiness, he confined himself to a gesture which he habitually employed whenever any perplexing question came into his mind. That is, he passed his hand across his forehead, dried his eyes, and wiped his glasses. And he could never be consoled for the loss of his wife, but used to say to my grandfather during the 2 years for which he survived her, "It's a funny thing now. I very often think of my poor wife, but I cannot think of her very much at any one time." "Often, but a little at a time, like poor old Swann," became one of my grandfather's favourite phrases, which he would apply to all kinds of things. And I should have assumed that this father of Swann's had been a monster if my grandfather, whom I regarded as a better judge than myself, and whose word was my law, and often led me in the long run to pardon offences which I should have been inclined to condemn, had not gone on to exclaim, "But after all, he had a heart of gold." For many years, albeit, and especially before his marriage, Monsieur Swann the younger came often to see them at Combray, my great-aunt and grandparents never suspected that he had entirely ceased to live in the kind of society which his family had frequented, or that, under the sort of incognito which the name of Swann gave him among us, they were harbouring, with the complete innocence of a family of honest innkeepers who have in their midst some distinguished highwayman and never know it, one of the smartest members of the Jockey Club, a particular friend of the Comte de Paris and of the Prince of Wales, and one of the men most sought after in the aristocratic world of the Faubourg Saint-Germain. Our utter ignorance of the brilliant part which Swann was playing in the world of fashion was, of course, due in part to his own reserve and discretion, but also to the fact that middle-class people in those days took what was almost a Hindu view of society, which they held to consist of sharply defined castes, so that everyone at his birth found himself called to that station in life which his parents already occupied, and nothing except the chance of a brilliant career or of a good marriage could extract you from that station or admit you to a superior caste. Monsieur Swann, the father, had been a stockbroker, and so young Swann found himself immured for life in a caste where one's fortune, as in a list of taxpayers, varied between such and such limits of income. We knew the people with whom his father had associated, and so we knew his own associates, the people with whom he was in a position to mix. If he knew other people besides, those were youthful acquaintances on whom the old friends of the family, like my relatives, shut their eyes all the more good-naturedly, that Swann himself, after he was left an orphan, still came most faithfully to see us. But we would have been ready to wager that the people outside our acquaintance whom Swann knew were of the sort to whom he would not have dared to raise his hat had he met them while he was walking with ourselves. Had there been such a thing as a determination to apply to Swann a social coefficient peculiar to himself, as distinct from all the other sons of other stockbrokers in his father's position, his coefficient would have been rather lower than theirs, because, leading a very simple life and having always had a craze for antiques and pictures, he now lived and piled up his collections in an old house which my grandmother longed to visit, but which stood on the Quai d'Orléans, a neighbourhood in which my great-aunt thought it most degrading to be quartered. "Are you really a connoisseur now?" she would say to him. "I ask for your own sake, as you're likely to have fakes palmed off on you by the dealers." For she did not, in fact, endow him with any critical faculty, and had no great opinion of the intelligence of a man who, in conversation, would avoid serious topics, and showed a very dull preciseness, not only when he gave us kitchen recipes, going into the most minute details, but even when my grandmother's sisters were talking to him about art. When challenged by them to give an opinion or to express his admiration for some picture, he would remain almost impolitely silent, and would then make amends by furnishing, if he could, some fact or other about the gallery in which the picture was hung, or the date at which it had been painted. But as a rule, he would content himself with trying to amuse us by telling us the story of his latest adventure, and he would have a fresh story for us on every occasion, with someone whom we ourselves knew, such as the Combray chemist, or our cook, or our coachman. These stories certainly used to make my great-aunt laugh, but she could never tell whether that was on account of the absurd parts which Swann invariably made himself play in the adventures, or of the wit that he showed in telling us of them. "It's easy to see that you are a regular character, Monsieur Swann." As she was the only member of our family who could be described as a trifle common, she would always take care to remark to strangers when Swann was mentioned that he could easily, if he had wished to, have lived in the Boulevard Haussmann or the Avenue de l'Opéra, and that he was the son of old Monsieur Swann, who must have left 4 or 5 million francs, but that it was a fad of his. A fad which, moreover, she thought was bound to amuse other people so much that in Paris, when Monsieur Swann called on New Year's Day, bringing her a little packet of marron glacé, she never failed, if there were strangers in the room, to say to him, "Well, Monsieur Swann, and do you still live next door to the bonded vaults, so as to be sure of not missing your train when you go to Lyon?" And she would peep out of the corner of her eye over her glasses at the other visitors. But if anyone had suggested to my aunt that this Swann, who in his capacity as the son of old Monsieur Swann, was fully qualified to be received by any of the upper middle class, the most respected barristers and solicitors of Paris, though he was perhaps a trifle inclined to let this hereditary privilege go into abeyance, had another almost secret existence of a wholly different kind, that when he left our house in Paris saying that he must go home to bed, he would no sooner have turned the corner than he would stop, retrace his steps, and be off to some drawing room on whose like no stockbroker or associate of stockbrokers had ever set eyes. That would have seemed to my aunt as extraordinary as, to a woman of wider reading, the thought of being herself on terms of intimacy with Aristaeus, of knowing that he would, when he had finished his conversation with her, plunge deep into the realms of Thetis, into an empire veiled from mortal eyes, in which Virgil depicts him as being received with open arms. Or to be content with an image more likely to have occurred to her, for she had seen it painted on the plates we used for biscuits at Cambrai, as the thought of having had to dinner Ali Baba, who, as soon as he found himself alone and unobserved, would make his way into the cave, resplendent with its unsuspected treasures. One day, when he had come to see us after dinner in Paris, and had begged pardon for being in evening clothes, Françoise, when he had gone, told us that she had got it from his coachman that he had been dining with a princess. "A pretty sort of princess," drawled my aunt. "I know them." And she shrugged her shoulders without raising her eyes from her knitting, serenely ironical. Altogether my aunt used to treat him with scant ceremony. Since she was of the opinion that he ought to feel flattered by our invitations, she thought it only right and proper that he should never come to see us in summer without a basket of peaches or raspberries from his garden, and that from each of his visits to Italy he should bring back some photographs of old masters for me. It seemed quite natural, therefore, to send to him whenever we wanted a recipe for some special sauce or for a pineapple salad for one of our big dinner parties to which he himself would not be invited, not seeming of sufficient importance to be served up to new friends who might be in our house for the first time. If the conversation turned upon the princes of the House of France, "Gentlemen, you and I will never know, will we? And don't want to, do we?" my great-aunt would say tartly to Swann, who had perhaps a letter from Twickenham in his pocket. She would make him play accompaniments and turn over music on evenings when my grandmother's sister sang, manipulating this creature, so rare and refined at other times and in other places, with the rough simplicity of a child who will play with some curio from the cabinet no more carefully than if it were a penny toy. Certainly the Swan, who was a familiar figure in all the clubs of those days, differed hugely from the Swan created in my great-aunt's mind when, of an evening in our little garden at Cambrai, after the two shy peals had sounded from the gate, she would vitalize by injecting into it everything she had ever heard about the Swan family, the vague and unrecognizable shape which began to appear, with my grandmother in its wake, against a background of shadows, and could at last be identified by the sound of its voice. But then, even in the most insignificant details of our daily life, none of us can be said to constitute a material whole, which is identical for everyone, and need only be turned up like a page in an account book or the record of a will. Our social personality is created by the thoughts of other people. Even the simple act which we describe as seeing someone we know is, to some extent, an intellectual process. We pack the physical outline of the creature we see with all the ideas we have already formed about him. And in the complete picture of him which we compose in our minds, those ideas have certainly the principal place. In the end, they come to fill out so completely the curve of his cheeks, to follow so exactly the line of his nose, they blend so harmoniously in the sound of his voice, that these seem to be no more than a transparent envelope, so that each time we see the face or hear the voice, it is our own ideas of him which we recognize and to which we listen. And so, no doubt from the Swan they had built up for their own purposes, my family had left out in their ignorance a whole crowd of the details of his daily life in the world of fashion, details by means of which other people, when they met him, saw all the graces enthroned in his face and stopping at the line of his arched nose as at a natural frontier. But they contrived also to put into a face from which its distinction had been evicted a face vacant and roomy as an untenanted house, to plant in the depths of its unvalued eyes a lingering sense, uncertain but not unpleasing, half memory and half oblivion, of idle hours spent together after our weekly dinners, round the card table or in the garden, during our companionable country life. Our friend's bodily frame had been so well lined with this sense, and with various earlier memories of his family, that their own special swan had become to my people a complete and living creature. So that even now I have the feeling of leaving someone I know for another quite different person when, going back in memory, I pass from the swan whom I knew later and more intimately to this early swan. This early swan in whom I can distinguish the charming mistakes of my childhood, and who, incidentally, is less like his successor than he is like the other people I knew at that time, as though one's life were a series of galleries in which all the portraits of any one period had a marked family likeness, the same, so to speak, tonality. This early swan, abounding in leisure, fragrant with the scent of the great chestnut tree, of baskets of raspberries, and of a sprig of tarragon. And yet one day, when my grandmother had gone to ask some favour of a lady whom she had known at the Sacré-Cœur, and with whom, because of our caste theory, she had not cared to keep up any degree of intimacy in spite of several common interests, the Marquise de Villeparisis of the famous house of Bouillon, this lady had said to her, "I think you know Monsieur Swann very well. He is a great friend of my nephew's, the Delhomme." My grandmother had returned from the call full of praise for the house, which overlooked some gardens, and in which Madame de Villeparisis had advised her to rent a flat, and also for a repairing tailor and his daughter, who kept a little shop in the courtyard, into which she had gone to ask them to put a stitch in her skirt, which she had torn on the staircase. My grandmother had found these people perfectly charming. The girl, she said, was a jewel, and the tailor a most distinguished man, the finest she had ever seen. For in her eyes, distinction was a thing wholly independent of social position. She was in ecstasies over some answer the tailor had made, saying to Mama, "Sévigné would not have said it better." And by way of contrast, of a nephew of Madame de Villeparisis, whom she had met at the house, "My dear, he is so common." Now the effect of that remark about Swann had been not to raise him in my great-aunt's estimation, but to lower Madame de Villeparisis. It appeared that the deference which, on my grandmother's authority, we owed to Madame de Villeparisis imposed on her the reciprocal obligation to do nothing that would render her less worthy of our regard, and that she had failed in her duty in becoming aware of Swann's existence and in allowing members of her family to associate with him. "How should she know Swann? A lady whom you always made out was related to Marshal MacMahon." This view of Swann's social atmosphere, which prevailed in my family, seemed to be confirmed later on by his marriage with a woman of the worst class. You might almost say a fast woman, whom, to do him justice, he never attempted to introduce to us, for he continued to come to us alone, though he came more and more seldom, but from whom they thought they could establish, on the assumption that he had found her there, the circle, unknown to them, in which he ordinarily moved. But on one occasion, my grandfather read in a newspaper that Monsieur Swann was one of the most faithful attendants at the Sunday luncheons given by the Duc de X, whose father and uncle had been among our most prominent statesmen in the reign of Louis-Philippe. Now, My grandfather was curious to learn all the little details which might help him to take a mental share in the private lives of men like Molé, the Duc Pasquier, or the Duc de Broglie. He was delighted to find the Swan associated with people who had known them. My great-aunt, however, interpreted this piece of news in a sense discreditable to Swan. For anyone who chose his associates outside the caste in which he had been born and bred, outside his proper station, was condemned to utter degradation in her eyes. It seemed to her that such a one abdicated all claim to enjoy the fruits of those friendly relations with people of good position, which prudent parents cultivate and store up for their children's benefit. For my great-aunt had actually ceased to see the son of a lawyer we had known, because he had married a highness, and had thereby stepped down in her eyes from the respectable position of a lawyer's son to that of those adventurers, upstart footmen or stable-boys mostly, to whom we read that queens have sometimes shown their favours. She objected, therefore, to my grandfather's plan of questioning Swan, when next he came to dine with us, about these people whose friendship with him we had discovered. On the other hand, my grandmother's two sisters, elderly spinsters who shared her nobility of character but lacked her intelligence, declared that they could not conceive what pleasure their brother-in-law could find in talking about such trifles. They were ladies of lofty ambition, who for that reason were incapable of taking the least interest in what might be called the pinchbeck things of life, even when they had an historic value, or, generally speaking, in anything that was not directly associated with some object aesthetically precious. So complete was their negation of interest in anything which seemed directly or indirectly a part of our everyday life that their sense of hearing, which had gradually come to understand its own futility when the tone of the conversation at the dinner table became frivolous or merely mundane, without the two old ladies being able to guide it back to the topic dear to themselves, would leave its receptive channels unemployed so effectively that they were actually becoming atrophied. So that if my grandfather wished to attract the attention of the two sisters, he would have to make use of some alarm signals, as mad doctors adopt in dealing with their distracted patients, as by beating several times on a glass with the blade of a knife, fixing them at the same time with a sharp word and a compelling glance, violent methods which the said doctors are apt to bring with them into their everyday life among the sane, either from force of professional habit or because they think the whole world a trifle mad. Their interest grew, however, when, the day before Swan was to dine with us, and when he had made them a special present of a case of Asti, my great-aunt, who had in her hand a copy of the Figaro, in which, to the name of a picture then on view in a Corot exhibition, were added the words, "From the collection of Monsieur Charles Swan," asked, "Did you see that Swan is mentioned in the Figaro?" "But I have always told you," said my grandmother, "that he had plenty of taste."
"You would, of course," retorted my great-aunt, "say anything just to seem different from us."
For knowing that my grandmother never agreed with her, and not being quite confident that it was her own opinion which the rest of us invariably endorsed, she wished to extort from us a wholesale condemnation of my grandmother's views, against which she hoped to force us into solidarity with her own. But we sat silent. My grandmother's sisters, having expressed a desire to mention to Swan this reference to him in the Figaro, my great-aunt dissuaded them. Whenever she saw in others an advantage, however trivial, which she herself lacked, she would persuade herself that it was no advantage at all, but a drawback, and would pity, so as not to have to envy them.
"I don't think that would please him at all. I know very well. I should hate to see my name printed like that, as large as life, in the paper, and I shouldn't feel at all flattered if anyone spoke to me about it."
She did not, however, put any very great pressure on my grandmother's sisters, for they, in their horror of vulgarity, had brought to such a fine art the concealment of a personal illusion in a wealth of ingenious circumlocution that it would often pass unnoticed even by the person to whom it was addressed. As for my mother, her only thought was of managing to induce my father to consent to speak to Swan, not of his wife, but of his daughter, whom he worshipped, and for whose sake it was understood that he had ultimately made his unfortunate marriage.
"You need only say a word. Just ask him how she is. It must be so very hard for him."
My father, however, was annoyed. "No, no, you have the most absurd ideas. It would be utterly ridiculous." But the only one of us in whom the prospect of Swan's arrival gave rise to an unhappy foreboding was myself. And that was because, on the evenings when there were visitors, or just Monsieur Swan in the house, Mamma did not come up to my room. I did not at that time have dinner with the family. I came out to the garden after dinner, and at 9 I said good night and went to bed. But on these evenings I used to dine earlier than the others, and to come in afterwards and sit at table until 8 o'clock, when it was understood that I must go upstairs. That frail and precious kiss, which Mamma used always to leave upon my lips when I was in bed and just going to sleep, I had to take with me from the dining-room to my own, and to keep inviolate all the time that it took me to undress, without letting its sweet charm be broken, without letting its volatile essence diffuse itself and evaporate. And just on those very evenings when I must needs take most pains to receive it with due formality, I had to snatch it, to seize it instantly and in public, without even having the time or being properly free to apply to what I was doing the punctiliousness which madmen use, who compel themselves to exclude all other thoughts from their minds while they are shutting a door, so that when the sickness of uncertainty sweeps over them again, they can triumphantly face and overcome it with the recollection of the precise moment in which the door was shut. We were all in the garden when the double peal of the gate bell sounded shyly. Everyone knew that it must be Swan, and yet they looked at one another inquiringly and sent my grandmother scouting. "See that you thank him intelligibly for the wine," my grandfather warned his two sisters-in-law. "You know how good it is, and it is a huge case."
"Now, don't start whispering," said my great-aunt. "How would you like to come into a house and find everyone muttering to themselves?"
"Ah, there's Monsieur Swan," cried my father. "Let's ask him if he thinks it will be fine tomorrow."
My mother fancied that a word from her would wipe out all the unpleasantness which my family had contrived to make Swan feel since his marriage. She found an opportunity to draw him aside for a moment, but I followed her. I could not bring myself to let her go out of reach of me while I felt that in a few minutes I should have to leave her in the dining-room and go up to my bed without the consoling thought, as on ordinary evenings, that she would come up later to kiss me. "Now, Monsieur Swan," she said, "do tell me about your daughter. I'm sure she shows a taste already for nice things, like her papa."
"Come along and sit down here with us all on the veranda," said my grandfather, coming up to him. My mother had to abandon the quest, but managed to extract from the restriction itself a further refinement of thought, as great poets do when the tyranny of rhyme forces them into the discovery of their finest lines.
"We can talk about her again when we are by ourselves," she said, or rather whispered to Swan. "It is only a mother who can understand. I'm sure that hers would agree with me."
And so we all sat down round the iron table. I should have liked not to think of the hours of anguish which I should have to spend that evening alone in my room, without the possibility of going to sleep.
I tried to convince myself that they were of no importance, really, since I should have forgotten them next morning, and to fix my mind on thoughts of the future, which would carry me as on a bridge across the terrifying abyss that yawned at my feet. But my mind, strained by this foreboding, distended like the look which I shot at my mother, would not allow any other impression to enter. Thoughts did, indeed, enter it, but only on the condition that they left behind them every element of beauty or even of quaintness by which I might have been distracted or beguiled. As a surgical patient by means of a local anaesthetic can look on with a clear consciousness while an operation is being performed upon him and yet feel nothing, I could repeat to myself some favourite lines, or watch my grandfather attempting to talk to Swann about the Duc d'Audriffet-Pasquier, without being able to kindle any emotion from one or amusement from the other. Hardly had my grandfather begun to question Swann about that orator, when one of my grandmother's sisters, in whose ears the question echoed like a solemn but untimely silence which her natural politeness bade her interrupt, addressed the other with, "Just fancy, Flora, I met a young Swedish governess today who told me some most interesting things about the cooperative movement in Scandinavia. We really must have her to dine here one evening." "To be sure," said her sister Flora, "but I haven't wasted my time either. I met such a clever old gentleman at Monsieur Vinteuil's, who knows Maubon quite well, and Maubon has told him every little thing about how he gets up his parts. It is the most interesting thing I ever heard. He is a neighbour of Monsieur Vinteuil's, and I never knew. And he is so nice besides."
"Monsieur Vinteuil is not the only one who has nice neighbours," cried my Aunt Celine, in a voice which seemed loud because she was so timid, and seemed forced because she had been planning the little speech for so long, darting as she spoke what she called a significant glance at Swann. And my Aunt Flora, who realized that this veiled utterance was Celine's way of thanking Swann intelligibly for the asti, looked at him with a blend of congratulation and irony, either just because she wished to underline her sister's little epigram, or because she envied Swann his having inspired it, or merely because she imagined that he was embarrassed and could not help having a little fun at his expense. "I think it would be worthwhile," Flora went on, "to have this old gentleman to dinner. When you get him upon Maubon or Madame Materna, he will talk for hours on end."
"That must be delightful," sighed my grandfather, in whose mind nature had unfortunately forgotten to include any capacity whatsoever for becoming passionately interested in the cooperative movement among the ladies of Sweden or in the methods employed by Maubon to get up his parts, just as it had forgotten to endow my grandmother's two sisters with a grain of that precious salt which one has oneself to add to taste in order to extract any savour from a narrative of the private life of Molé or of the Comte de Paris. "I say," exclaimed Swann to my grandfather, "what I was going to tell you has more to do than you might think with what you were asking me just now. For in some respects there has been very little change. I came across a passage in Saint-Simon this morning which would have amused you. It is in the volume which covers his mission to Spain, not one of the best, little more, in fact, than a journal, but at least it is a journal wonderfully well written, which fairly distinguishes it from the devastating journalism that we feel bound to read in these days, morning, noon, and night."
"I do not agree with you. There are some days when I find reading the papers very pleasant indeed," my Aunt Flora broke in, to show Swann that she had read the note about his Corot in the Figaro. "Yes," Aunt Celine went one better, "when they write about things or people in whom we are interested."
"I don't deny it,"
answered Swan in some bewilderment. The fault I find with our journalism is that it forces us to take an interest in some fresh triviality or other every day, whereas only 3 or 4 books in a lifetime give us anything that is of real importance. Suppose that every morning, when we tore the wrapper off our paper with fevered hands, a transmutation were to take place, and we were to find inside it, oh, I don't know, shall we say, Pascal's Pensée. He articulated the title with an ironic emphasis, so as not to appear pedantic. And then, in the gilt and tooled volumes which we open once in 10 years, he went on, showing that contempt for the things of this world which some men of the world like to affect, we should read that the Queen of the Hellenes had arrived at Cannes, or that the Princesse de Léon had given a fancy dress ball. In that way, we should arrive at the right proportion between information and publicity. But at once regretting that he had allowed himself to speak, even in jest, of serious matters, he added ironically, "We are having a most entertaining conversation. I cannot think why we climb to these lofty summits." And then, turning to my grandfather, "Well, Saint-Simon tells how Meulevrier had the audacity to offer his hand to his sons. You remember how he says of Meulevrier, 'Never did I find in that coarse bottle anything but ill-humour, boorishness, and folly.'"
"Coarse or not, I know bottles in which there is something very different," said Flora briskly, feeling bound to thank Swan as well as her sister, since the present of Asti had been addressed to them both. Céline began to laugh. Swan was puzzled, but went on, "I cannot say whether it was his ignorance or a trap," writes Saint-Simon. "He wished to give his hand to my children. I noticed it in time to prevent him." My grandfather was already in ecstasies over ignorance or a trap, but Miss Céline, the name of Saint-Simon, a man of letters, having arrested the complete paralysis of her sense of hearing, had grown angry.
"What? You admire that, do you? Well, it is clever enough. But what is the point of it? Does he mean that one man isn't as good as another? What difference can it make whether he is a duke or a groom, so long as he is intelligent and good? He had a fine way of bringing up his children, your Saint-Simon, if he didn't teach them to shake hands with all honest men. Really and truly, it's abominable, and you dare to quote it."
And my grandfather, utterly depressed, realizing how futile it would be for him, against this opposition, to attempt to get Swan to tell him the stories which would have amused him, murmured to my mother, "Just tell me again that line of yours which always comforts me so much on these occasions. Oh, yes. 'What virtues, Lord, thou makest us abhor.' Good, that is, very good." I never took my eyes off my mother. I knew that when they were at table I should not be permitted to stay there for the whole of dinner time, and that Mamma, for fear of annoying my father, would not allow me to give her in public the series of kisses that she would have had in my room. And so I promised myself that in the dining room, as they began to eat and drink, and as I felt the hour approach, I would put beforehand into this kiss, which was bound to be so brief and stealthy in execution, everything that my own efforts could put into it. Would look out very carefully first the exact spot on her cheek where I would imprint it, and would so prepare my thoughts that I might be able, thanks to these mental preliminaries, to consecrate the whole of the minute Mamma would allow me to the sensation of her cheek against my lips, as a painter who can have his subject for short sittings only prepares his palette, and from what he remembers and from rough notes does in advance everything which he possibly can do in his sitter's absence. But tonight, before the dinner bell had sounded, my grandfather said with unconscious cruelty, "The little man looks tired. He'd better go up to bed. Besides, we are dining late tonight." And my father, who was less scrupulous than my grandmother or mother in observing the letter of a treaty, went on,
Yes, run along, to bed with you.
I would have kissed Mama then and there, but at that moment the dinner bell rang.
No, no, leave your mother alone. You've said good night quite enough. These exhibitions are absurd. Go on upstairs.
And so I must set forth without viaticum, must climb each step of the staircase against my heart, as the saying is, climbing in opposition to my heart's desire, which was to return to my mother, since she had not, by her kiss, given my heart leave to accompany me forth. That hateful staircase, up which I always passed with such dismay, gave out a smell of varnish which had to some extent absorbed, made definite and fixed the special quality of sorrow that I felt each evening, and made it perhaps even more cruel to my sensibility, because when it assumed this olfactory guise, my intellect was powerless to resist it. When we have gone to sleep with a maddening toothache, and are conscious of it only as a little girl whom we attempt time after time to pull out of the water, or as a line of Molière which we repeat incessantly to ourselves, it is a great relief to wake up, so that our intelligence can disentangle the idea of toothache from any artificial semblance of heroism or rhythmic cadence. It was the precise converse of this relief which I felt when my anguish at having to go up to my room invaded my consciousness in a manner infinitely more rapid, instantaneous almost, a manner at once insidious and brutal as I breathed in, a far more poisonous thing than any moral penetration, the peculiar smell of the varnish upon that staircase. Once in my room, I had to stop every loophole, to close the shutters, to dig my own grave as I turned down the bedclothes, to wrap myself in the shroud of my nightshirt. But before burying myself in the iron bed which had been placed there because, on summer nights, I was too hot among the rep curtains of the four-poster, I was stirred to revolt and attempted the desperate stratagem of a condemned prisoner. I wrote to my mother, begging her to come upstairs for an important reason which I could not put in writing. My fear was that Françoise, my aunt's cook, who used to be put in charge of me when I was at Combray, might refuse to take my note. I had a suspicion that in her eyes, to carry a message to my mother when there was a stranger in the room would appear flatly inconceivable, just as it would be for the doorkeeper of a theatre to hand a letter to an actor upon the stage. For things which might or might not be done, she possessed a code at once imperious, abundant, subtle, and uncompromising on points themselves, imperceptible or irrelevant, which gave it a resemblance to those ancient laws which combine such cruel ordinances as the massacre of infants at the breast with prohibitions of exaggerated refinement against seething the kid in his mother's milk or eating of the sinew which is upon the hollow of the thigh. This code, if one could judge it by the sudden obstinacy which she would put into her refusal to carry out certain of our instructions, seemed to have foreseen such social complications and refinements of fashion as nothing in Françoise's surroundings or in her career as a servant in a village household could have put into her head. And we were obliged to assume that there was latent in her some past existence in the ancient history of France, noble and little understood, just as there is in those manufacturing towns where old mansions still testify to their former courtly days, and chemical workers toil among delicately sculptured scenes of the miracle of Theophilus or the Quatre Fils Aimants.